In Haiti was I born as a slave. More than 150 years in the past, with a power I do not fully understand. I am known as Jean-Pierre Desperrois, and Destiny, she calls my name. Part 3. Supreme Justice. Chapter 14. The Caravan. It is night. I am now Ungan. Ungan. I have waited for this moment my whole life. 13 long years. Perhaps not such a long time, but for me, all I know. My head, it still hurts from the vision I saw earlier today. The crossroads, the whiteness, Faye? That shadow, the shadow that blocked out the sun, Legba? It feels like it was years ago. It feels like a dream. But my Baka, it is still warm. On this island, there is no escape. Yes, there is land on the other side of the ocean, but it has been many years since there has been a ship in the harbor, not since the slaves won their freedom. No white man has dared to sail here. Even if they dared to sail a ship here, no black would be allowed on board of it. Of course, I have heard the rumors of the men from Port-au-Prince who built a raft from logs. They left and never returned, or so some say. But never to return, say those who talk of such things. It is most likely that their bodies lie far below the surface of the water. But if there is truth to what I saw in my trance, if there is truth to what they tell me, if indeed I am the son of Legba, if indeed my Baka can take me anywhere, if indeed I am the only one with this power, if there is truth to what they tell me, I can leave. I can leave. To travel as far as is possible away from this place, not to just another place, but to another time? How far away is possible? Across an entire ocean? How far in the future is possible? 10 years? 100 years? More? I vowed that one day I would leave this place. I would leave this place and never come back. For the love of my father, for what do I wait? Never to come back. I close my fingers around my Baka. I must pass Ife, but its fingers, they grab hold of me. I try to keep my eyes shut to focus on Tunis, on the year 1931, on Gada. Something grabs my shirt, I hear rip. Nothing exists in Ife except the dead and the Loa. I cannot slow, or I will not make it back home. It is hot. Not hot the way Haiti was hot, where you drip with sweat. No. Hot the way an oven is hot, and the sweat, it evaporates before it has time to drip. And it is bright. Even with my eyes still closed, the brightness, it penetrates my lids. It makes the darkness of my closed eyes to be bright orange. I can feel the sun on my skin. Even on my black skin, I feel it burn. It would appear that I have not landed where I had hoped, because this is certainly not the secret office that belongs to Gada. Another reason I hate to jump. I open my eyes, but the brightness, it is too much. I hold my hand above my eyes to block out the sun. Where am I? When am I? I lie next to some bushes. The ground, it slopes down to my left. a black scorpion, 6 inches from my head, works its way through the grass and the sand with its many legs. How I envy this scorpion right now. It is oblivious to the workings of space and of time. It only notices the here and the now. I push myself to my knees, to my feet. My stomach churns. It always churns after travel like this. I've landed on a hill. Climbed to the top of the hill to get my bearings. Oh, my legs will not hold me to walk yet. To stand, yes, but to walk, not yet. So I crawl. I push myself to my feet. To the south, there is nothing but sand and dirt and trees of much scrubbiness, so unlike the trees of Haiti. But to the north, maybe 7 miles, I see the reflection of light upon water and the outskirts of a city I know. My home, the city of Tunis. I look down at myself. I'm still dressed in the clothing of Haiti. My shirt sleeve is ripped. I'm covered in the dust of the ground over which I've just crawled. I look like a pirate. A very dirty pirate. My hand, it touches my sternum. Yes, my baka is still there, thank God. Now my hand, it reaches to my face. A raised scar runs across my nose and cheek. So, it was no dream. The people I killed, they were no dream. Oh, my stomach flips. My breakfast, it comes up and out to the ground at my feet. Oh, that's better now. No, I still feel terrible. Some of my breakfast has landed on my boot. I have nothing with which to wipe it off. No matter, it will dry. I walk as far as my legs will move me from the puddle of vomit. 9 steps. I sit because I cannot walk any further. The sun, it makes my eyes hurt. I close my eyes. No help. I told Gada I would be gone 2 weeks. For me, I've been gone for more than 2 weeks. How does one even track the weeks when one has traveled more than 175 years back and forth through time? And anyway, it does not matter. I'm here now for the next 2 days at least, until I am to make my recovery in fullness. And perhaps I wish I could to travel back to before the murders in Tunis they took place, but no. I've discovered the hard way that it is not possible to exist in the same time I already inhabit, like trying to make 2 magnets to touch. Even to try causes my head to split with pain. So, here you are. In the city, the police, they will be looking for me. A man cannot escape from solitary confinement without the police to look. And a man who is wanted for the murder of 3 people, he cannot presume to walk down the middle of a street without someone recognizing him from the wanted posters, no? And a man in a pirate costume, people will look at him twice in the street. How am I to return to Tunis? But first, shade and water. I look to the south. Movement. A line of movement. Of people and carts and horses. The line, it stretches through the valley below and around the curve on the next hill. A caravan. A huge caravan, perhaps of Arab, from the looks of it. Hard to tell from this distance. It takes all my strength to push myself to my feet. My legs, they still wobble, but I force them to walk. 1 step. 2 steps. It is just a little bit more easy now that I walk down and not up the hill. 3 steps, but no, I misjudge, and now the ground, it is above me, and the sky below, I eat dirt. I flip over and over as gravity pulls me down the hill. The dust chokes me. I try to throw up again, but nothing is left to throw up. I look up. The hill, it rises behind me. My fall has left a trail in the dirt. From the caravan I hear the thudding sound of hooves. A man on horseback gallops toward me, the fabric of his robes and turban flap behind him like wings. There is a glint of light off something, a scimitar. Yeah, the figure has drawn a sword. I feel too sick to run, and even if I were to run, he is on horseback. I lie on the ground and hold my hands where he can see them and hope he does not use the sword to slice them off as I lie there. The horse comes straight toward me. I do not move. The hooves thunder closer and closer. The rider pulls his horse to a stop not 2 feet from where I lie. He points his sword directly at me. He's covered head to toe in white fabric. His headdress covers all of his face except his eyes. The sun is behind him, making me to be practically blind. He yells something at me, but it is a language I do not understand. He gestures with his free hand. He wants me to stand. I force myself to my feet. Oh, another wave of nausea. He shouts something at me. I shake my head. It hurts to move my head.
Do you speak French?
I say in French. My voice, it is barely a whisper. I still hold my hands in the air. He shouts a short question at me. I try again, louder.
Do you speak French?
Oui.
He says. He does not move his sword. I lift my head. I look him directly in the eye. It takes every effort not to squint.
My name is Jean-Pierre d'Esperois. I am in need of water and shelter from the sun. I mean you no harm.
Did you say Jean-Pierre d'Esperois?
I nod. He moves his horse 1 step closer to me. He now sits directly above me. He keeps his sword to be pointed at my neck.
You're a wanted man, Jean-Pierre d'Esparois. Your corpse is worth 10,000 francs.
Is that all?
It is all I can do to remain on my feet and not collapse to the ground. How far from Tunis have the authorities spread the word of the bounty on my head? Is there anywhere I can go that is safe? My hands fall. I press my palms against my knees to try to keep myself to stand. I can only hope his sword is sharp enough to cut off my head in 1 clean strike. I close my eyes.
But you're worth more to me alive,
he says.
Much more.
He doesn't mean to kill me. I look up at him. Keeping his sword pointed at me, the man dismounts from his horse. He removes his head covering. He grabs my arm before I can move it away and forces me to stand straight. I look into his face. He smiles. Why does he smile? What does he want from me?
Do you not recognize me, Jean-Pierre? Has it been that long?
He knows me? Who is this man? There's something familiar about his face, his eyes, his goatee, his brown skin. What is it? Yes, I remember. My contact at the salt mines of Tao Deni. No wonder I did not recognize him. I only see him once a year. This caravan transports salt. My salt. I smile at him.
Farouk al-Nassari,
I say. I have no strength to say more.
You look terrible.
I feel terrible.
Here.
From his robes, he pulls a canteen. Not the skin, but a canteen made from metal. Oh, I thrust it to my lips. Water. Clean, fresh water. I take 3 gulps. I hand it back toward him, but al-Nassari, he does not take it.
You need it more than I,
he says.
What is this you're wearing?
He points to my clothing. I shake my head.
Our meeting, it is the will of Allah, Jean-Pierre. Too astounding to be a coincidence.
He steps back to get a good look at me.
What happened to your face?
I touched the scar. How long has it been since I looked in a mirror? How terrible does it look?
A knife. Long story.
I take another drink of water. Nassari says,
are you headed in or out?
I am not certain what he means. He sees my confusion.
In or out of the city?
In.
I knew you were brave, old friend,
he says.
I didn't think you were stupid.
There is no other choice.
I cough again and I spit. It is all I can do to remain on my feet. Nasari takes me in with his eyes. He looks at me just sideways.
Did you kill those men?
It is clear he thinks I may have. Did I kill the men in Tunis? I'm not even sure how to answer this question. I do not know myself. I do not think I did. He frowns as if to ask another question, but instead he says,
Come.
He takes the reins of his horse in one hand and my arm in the other, and together we walk it back to the caravan.
You can't go into Tunis looking like that,
says Nasari.
First of all, your clothes will attract attention, and second, your face is posted everywhere. Even with that scar, someone will recognize you.
I know. I need to get to the Medina. A friend of mine there can help me. I hope she can help me.
Indeed, you are lucky to run into me. We have some extra robes. We can disguise you, at least until we get through the checkpoints.
Checkpoints? He sees the look of concern on my face.
There are three of them before we get to the souk.
Three checkpoints. Then, Gada. We arrive at the caravan. Nasari shouts in his native tongue to one of the other men. The eyes of this man, they open wide. Then he smiles and nods. He gets down from his horse and pulls a large piece of white fabric from his saddlebag. He hands it to me, shaking his head. His face, it wears a smirk.
Put these on,
says Nasari.
We'll be at the first checkpoint in about 30 minutes. Be sure to cover as much of your face as possible. We don't want the color of your skin to give you away.
The robe. It is long enough to cover my boots, and the sleeves hide my hands. I wrap the scarf around my head. Nasari laughs, undoes the scarf, and wraps it again. He plays with the fabric until he gives a nod of satisfaction.
Well, we can't hide your shoulders, but there have been women shaped more strangely than you in this world.
A woman? He looks one more time at my new costume.
Or maybe not.
He laughs. I'm not entirely comfortable with this arrangement. Nasari chuckles as he mounts his horse. It is not the custom of the Arab culture for women to ride horses, so I must walk alongside the men. I swallow another gulp from the canteen and pray that my legs hold out on me. Nasari shouts to the caravan, and we begin to move forward. Forward to Tunis. The water from the canteen, it helps my sickness, but the only thing that will truly cure me is time. Five actual women also walk alongside the caravan, but they do not come near to me. It would be inappropriate for me to talk to them anyway. The caravan is large. We walk slowly, slowly enough for my legs to keep up and for my stomach to keep the water down. So, I am once again left with my thoughts. The massacre at the Delacour plantation led to the manhunt that sent Macandal to the stake. So, would he have been discovered if I had not gone back in time, if I had not killed Madame Delacour? Why would the slave owners have searched the forest if not for that? Would Macandal have been caught at all? Would his revolution have succeeded? If the debt of Macandal can be attributed to me, and history played out exactly as it had before I went back to AD, then it was somehow fated that I would go back in time. That even before I was born, I had already gone back in time. That it was my destiny to go back in time. This is a thought to boggle the mind. I'm still not clear about what it was that Macandal was trying to accomplish. I mean, the freedom of the slave, certainly, but there was more.
He believed that by sacrificing humans to the Loire, he would be granted astounding power. He spoke of raising an army of empty ones. He wanted to collect their souls in my Baka to control them. To do what? With an army like that, why stop at 18? He brainwashed me and took away my memory. He almost had me to be killed as a sacrifice for the Loi. And for what? Macandal, this hero of the Haitian people, this martyr. Perhaps he started with the best of intentions, but his potions or power or something went to his head, and the good thoughts that he once had were turned to evil. That is the only word that can describe a man who would and did sacrifice human beings to the Loi. Evil. Just like the owners of the slaves. Can one evil fight another? If evil beats evil, who then is the victor? And how does this then connect back to Tunis in 1931? This is all crazy. Macandal was an escaped slave. He excelled in making poison. He had a small group of followers who failed to lead a slave rebellion. He was captured. He was burned at the stake. I imagine the rest. But Macandal was here in Tunisia. And for that, I am still a wanted man. My stomach, it churns. My head, it spins. My thoughts are too complex. The answer lies within my grasp. If I could only figure out which direction I should reach. What am I missing? What am I missing? Gada, her head, it is always clear. I must speak with Gada. About a mile from the first checkpoint, Nasari stops the caravan. The shipment for Tunis is small enough for Nasari and four other men to lead 6 horses into town. The rest of the caravan will wait here until Nasari finishes his business with me in Tunis. Even as we walk away, the others already begin to set up their tents. It takes 40 minutes for the 6 of us to walk to the checkpoint. It is my pace that holds us up. Between my headache and nausea, I can only walk so fast. I have to stop twice to throw up. The first checkpoint is on the far outskirts of the city. It consists of a small guardhouse and a gate at the road. Barbed wire fences stretch away from the guardhouse into the desert on either side. The French have moved fast to build all this. They must want to catch me very badly. Through the haze of heat from the sand, we can see the walls of the old city rise from the horizon like an island from the ocean. There is no one else here but 3 guards. 2 stand at the gate with machine guns. 1 sits in the guardhouse and peers at us through the open window. They look at us with suspicion. How far do the fences run? Can we go through the desert around them? No, there is no cover. They would shoot us before we took 3 steps. About 20 feet from the checkpoint, Nasari whispers that it is lucky we are the only ones at this crossing. Why? I say.
You'll see,
he says.
Now wait here.
Nasari signals the other man to wait with me. He moves to one of the guards at the gate. His papers are already in his outstretched hand. They are too far away for me to hear the conversation, so all I can do is wait and hope. The sun beats upon me, my stomach churns, and my head it spins. Nasari continues to talk with the guard. How long have they been talking? Too long. The guard is suspicious. He turns to look at the rest of us. He waves to one of the other guards, who points his machine gun toward us. It is all I can do to remain on my feet. The seconds tick into minutes. I pull out the canteen. It is empty. I need more water. But now Nasari stands before us. The gate at the checkpoint is raised.
Let's go,
he says. What did he tell the guard? I will compensate this man for his excellence. I will compensate this man for his excellence. I will compensate this man for his excellence. Oh, I hope I'll remember this when I'm in a position to do so. We walk past the makeshift hut and gate. Out of the corner of my eye, I can see the guard staring at me. Inside the hut, the guard picks up a telephone. He does not take his eyes off me. Look away, Jean-Pierre. What did Nasari tell them? How much did he pay them? No matter, we are true. I just pray that the guard on the phone is not making a call to the next checkpoint. At the walls of the old city, there is a line of about 30 people. This checkpoint stops the crowd at the ancient city gates. Just before the gates, there is another small group that seems to be transporting goods, but other than that, everyone on the line appears to be a single person or two people trying to go about their regular business. Some dress in European clothes, some in the robes of Arab, some have white skin, some black, some olive. Was this how it was before I went to AT? Strange. The sun beats down upon us. Now, in addition to my headache and nausea, I am covered in sweat. It is only a matter of time before one of the people in line notices that the woman behind them is much too big to be a woman. The couple in front of us complains loudly at the inconvenience of waiting in line.
2 weeks of this. Why haven't they captured him?
Says the man. So I have indeed been gone 2 weeks.
I heard he murdered 17 since his escape. 3 of them were French.
17 more murders? For the love of the Loi? But it was not me. I did not kill him. I was not here to kill him.
He's probably not even in Tunis anymore,
the man says.
If it were me, I'd go as far away from this place as possible.
Indeed. And so I did. Why did I come back? There was nowhere else to go, and I made a promise to Gada. Gada, how long until I set eyes on her again? An hour or less if I am not discovered. Please do not let me be discovered. The couple keeps up their chatter. I pray they do not turn around and notice me, but they are true to checkpoint now, and they still have not turned to look behind them. It is now our turn. None of the people in line seem to have noticed me, neither those in front of us, nor the people who have lined up behind, but now one of the guards stares at me. His thumb moves to release the safety of his machine gun. His index finger moves to the trigger. Another guard places out his hand, palm up.
Papers.
Nasari hands the guard his papers, but the guard shakes his head.
I need everyone's papers, not just yours.
I feel a drop of sweat run past my eye and down my cheek. The line behind us has grown long. Everyone looks restless. I try not to make eye contact with anyone. Please do not let them notice me. Nasari turns to face the 5 of us, collects the papers from the 4 men, then looks me in the eye and steps so close to me that our robes touch. His hands press against my stomach as if they are taking something from me. He shoves me 2 steps to my left and pivots me toward the guards. At this exact moment, he says loud enough for the guard to hear.
Thank you, mother.
Mother? He turns around and hands the guard the papers from the 4 other men and a 5th passport, too. The guard looks at each passport and then at each man. Then he squints up at me.
Nasari has managed to position us so that the sun is directly behind my head and directly in the eyes of the guard. It will be difficult for the guard to determine the color of my skin if I am a silhouette. A clever man, Nasari. The guard looks at me, then at the passport that passes as mine, then at Nasari.
"That's your mother,"
he says.
"She's not a that,"
says Nasari. The guard shrugs his shoulders and waves us through. I will compensate this man for his excellence. One more checkpoint to go. By the time we get to the third checkpoint, at the entrance to the covered labyrinth of the Medina, the crowd has grown so thick that we have to shove our way through. The four other men cling to the reins of their horses. The crowds and the heat make my head spin again. The crowd is so dense here that there is no line to get through this gate, just a mass of people. It quickly becomes clear that to pass this checkpoint, it is every man for himself. It also is clear that there are so many people here that none will notice an absurdly tall woman in Arab dress among them. With the crowd this thick, I am safe until we get to the checkpoint. I'm shoved back and forth in a swarm of people, and I am only barely able to keep up with Nasari and his couriers, but even though I am still nauseated and dizzy from the time travel, I feel myself to breathe freely for the first time since arriving back in Tunisia. Nasari, perhaps, has the elbows most sharp of anyone and moves us past those less aggressive than him. He would like to be rid of me as quickly as possible, not merely to help me, but to save his own skin, too. I am not entirely certain how he does it, for my head is really dizzy now, but we stand before the guard, and Nasari produces the passports one more time. The guard takes them, flips them open to the appropriate pages. A poster pasted to the wall behind the guard catches my eye. Wanted for murder. Below the words, a picture of me. Gada is just a few shops beyond the checkpoint. I take slow, deep breaths to keep my head from spinning off its axis. In just a few minutes, I will be able to recover in the safety of her hidden office. Perhaps she has even acquired some answers herself in the 2 weeks I have been away. And exactly at that moment, I feel a hand to brush against my shoulder, and my veil and my hood, they are gone.
You have been listening to Salt, The Lives and Times of Jean-Pierre Desperrois. I'm Jason Newlander, and I wrote and narrated the story. Buzz Moran provided additional voices. Buzz also produced this recording. Music by Adrian Quesada. There's more to Jean-Pierre Desperrois at theintergalacticnemesis.com. Salt is part of the One of Us podcast network.